Okay, questions? Could you explain the difference between intelligent design and creationism? Creationism could be used in different ways, but let me explain first intelligent design. Intelligent design is the idea that, what I was trying to explain, that the complexity, the order of living creatures shows an intelligent design. And basically we could just say in general, whenever you find an order being displayed by irrational creatures, right, we want to think that that order is the result of an intelligence that planned it. And that's the basic idea. And so intelligent design is simply recognizing that the order that we see requires an explanation that would be an intelligent design. Creationism would go further and say that in addition to a design governing it, the origin of a new species, etc., could only be by a kind of creation out of nothing. Or at least that's one way of understanding creationism. And we don't need to make that second step. Right? I'm not excluding that second step. It's just that the key thing is the design. That's the thing that we need to underline. Right? If God wanted to make use of one species to bring about another, such that he guided this, what in itself would be incredibly improbable, like the 1 in 10 to the 100th, etc. That's not going to happen by itself. But again, the rigged lottery can speed things up. And so God could use things like mutation and intelligent design to bring about a higher level. Because you're not getting something from nothing. You've got an intelligence that's planning the going from the lower to the higher. God can do it how he wants. He could use the means of chance and natural selection that he's guiding, or he could simply create a new species, and that would be creationism. Either way would work.
I agree with what you said, but very often the term creationism is a term that's associated with fundamental evangelical Christians who are not only positing intelligent designers, but also the specific God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of Jesus. So many scientists shy away from that.
Right.
They immediately see it as positing a religious,
Right. Right. And then it makes sense to the extent that if you're on the terrain of microbiology, well, you want to speak in terms of, in other words, you don't want to go beyond what the evidence gives you. Right? And if the evidence points to intelligent design, well, that's a very good outcome. Also, we don't want to in other words, it's not necessary to take a literalist reading of Genesis 1, right, with the 7 days, etc., being 7 24-hour periods. The Catholic understanding of the days of creation is that the days represent, or can represent, there's no reason why they can't represent, eras or ages or stages. Right? And so what Genesis 1 is showing us, rightly interpreted, is an unfolding that took place in stages, right? A gradual, which is exactly what science does show us. And so it's very important not to create unnecessary conflicts with science, which simply come out of ignorance of how do we understand what God is saying to us in these. And so I think Genesis 1 through 11 is truly about history, but it's expressed in a metaphorical way. Right? And so one example of that metaphorical way is days, right? The 7 days. Right? And so if we take it as 7 stages, well, that's we eliminate an unnecessary conflict with science. Right? Whereas creationism doesn't always make those distinctions. And the same thing would be true about, for example, when we talked about original sin. Right? Again, the apple is a metaphor for what's really going on, which we talked about 2 weeks ago. And that was Adam and Eve seeking a dominion over good and evil. In other words, seeking to arrogate to themselves, to appropriate to themselves an autonomy, a moral autonomy, to determine for themselves good and evil. And so that's not so easy. The Catholic is, we're aided by a magisterium of the church that gives us guidelines, and then whereas the Protestant doesn't have that aid. No? And so very often there's the fear, well, if I accept anything metaphorical, I'm going to lose everything, and so I have to take everything literalistically. And as Catholics, we're not faced with that dichotomy. Have you seen Expelled? No, I should, but I haven't.
Mm-hmm. I was the one who asked that question. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who has not seen the movie Expelled, it's done by Ben Stein.
Right, I've heard great things of it.
He's a very, very intelligent man. Mm-hmm. And it's a really simple way to understand the problem with not accepting intelligent design. I mean, he approaches it very logically and then goes to its logical conclusion. If you don't accept the fact that there is intelligent design, where can you go? Where could that lead you? And it's a really, really interesting, well-done movie, and I highly recommend get it from the library and watch it a couple of times.
And what's the name of it?
Expelled. Expelled.
Well, Ben, it's done like a documentary, yeah. And he interviews a lot of very pro-evolution people who mostly end up kind of sputtering.
They really don't come looking to him because he asks where did it all start, and they refuse to acknowledge anything besides matter just spontaneously happening. And it's really, really, if you bring it down to a layman's level, that's a good springboard for
you get, I'm sure if you get, if you have Netflix, you can get it on Netflix.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Gary? I'm going to take you up on that. Another question. Seems like evolutionists have to abandon the idea of time as a factor given the Cambrian explosion. In other words, they can't hide behind eons of time to explain the development of these incredible improbabilities. I think that's more or less true. They have to somehow get some explanation of long periods of stasis and then these sudden explosions. And they're really, that is contrary to the fundamental Darwinian system of the gradualness. Right? So I think that's an unexplained problem, as far as I know. Why don't scientists such as Dawkins, etc., accept this argument from an orderly universe? Well, I think that atheist scientists, they don't say that the world isn't orderly. In fact, they're generally the ones who are trying to make a theory of everything. And let's make a theory that explains everything. And so every scientist has a fundamental conviction of the orderliness of the universe. And that's why it's a kind of, with regard to evolution, it's somewhat contradictory, no? Because in every other part of science, you want to show how it has to be, it couldn't not be this way. Whereas in evolution, it's not, well, it could have been this way. Sure, it's 1 in 10 to the 100th, but if it could have been this way, then it must have been this way. Whereas, right, we don't do that in any other part of science. Right? We show that it had to be precisely this way. And I think that's very significant. Right, so the more scientists do science, the more they can't help but see the incredible order of the universe. And then that's why it's so good to do science. Right? That's why science is such a good thing. Not principally because it gives us utility. Science is wonderful first and foremost because it enables us to praise God more. I know of two students of philosophy who are totally insulted by the concept of intelligent design. Would you be able to discern why that would be? I'd have to.
There was a talk given at St. Francis de Sales by somebody who was very renowned in explaining and there were two guys there, and they were just livid. Then they just couldn't understand how it was like undermining the writings of previous philosophers or something. And I'm not sure. I never did understand.
I can't say anything. But all I can say is this: that it's. Intelligent design is in St. Thomas. It's the fifth way that he proves God's existence. And St. Thomas gives five different proofs that God exists. And the fifth way, he says, is the simplest. And it's the way used by most of mankind. And he reasons like this. When we look out in the world, we see that irrational creatures, brute animals, spiders, do things for an end. And that end is precisely what's best for them, making their web. The bird making his nest, flying 4,000 miles south in the winter, whatever. So they do things for an end, and they can't understand the end. Therefore, there must be an intelligence that moves them to their ends. And that intelligence we all call God. And so for St. Thomas, this is the easiest way to understand that God exists. And that's why I think Darwinian evolution, the way it's kind of promulgated in the media, the way it's put forth as a kind of ideology, has done more than any other single thing in promoting atheism. Because it takes away, or it makes people think that the most natural thought process in the world, from this incredible order of nature, there's a designer, it seems to say that you can't do that, that that's illegitimate. And so intelligent design is just simply a more modern form of St. Thomas' Fifth Way, using the contributions of contemporary science. Right, and it's philosophy, exactly. It's a beautiful collaboration between science and philosophy. That's what's so beautiful about it. It's not the person already chosen. In other words, I think the idea of the question is that there's a plan of God from all eternity that comes out in, when an egg and sperm come together, we get a new person, etc. That what seems to be chance in our world is in reality an incredible plan of the divine providence. And just as that's true in the human world, right? So we can't say anything was purely by chance, and it's by providence. The same thing is true, I think, with regard to evolution. Right? All these steps along the evolutionary ladder, right? That's not chance, that's providence. I mean, chance is a real thing. Right? Chance really occurs on one level, we could say on the horizontal level. Chance is, two people, by chance, they meet in the supermarket. And they weren't coming in, right? But it's not purely by chance, because God foresaw this from all eternity. Right? And the same thing is true in every step of the evolutionary process. Okay. If dust is used in the sense of dust equals animals, or primates, and Adam was created from dust, then wouldn't that contradict with the liturgy when it said on Ash Wednesday, to dust thou shalt return? In other words, we're going to turn back to primates? The liturgy, like the Bible, uses the common sense of mankind and doesn't rely on scientific hypotheses that are in one year and out the next. Right? And just like we're not to infer anything particularly scientific about the Bible speaking about the sun rising. Right? In other words, that's not an argument. The fact that the Bible says the sun rises, that's not an argument that the sun goes around the earth. It's simply that the Bible speaks in the language of common sense. And we too say the sun rises. And that doesn't mean we deny the Copernican theory. And so the same thing is true here, that the Bible doesn't speak the language of any particular scientific hypothesis that's going to rise in a certain course of human history, but speaks to all men of all times and places. Okay. You said that macroevolution can't be observed because it would take millions of years. However, could it be possible to observe it in organisms with much shorter reproductive cycles? Yeah, you would think so. Know that precisely by taking, I don't know, one-celled organisms or bacteria, it should be possible to see this. But the real difficulty would be to distinguishing micro from macro. In other words, at what point is this simply a variant of a species? At what point does it really become a new species in the philosophical sense? So now here's the difficulty. Scientists use a definition of species that's properly empirical. Philosophers use a species that means a different essence, a different kind of thing. And it's not always, just because something is a different species according to a scientific definition, doesn't mean it's really a different essence that you got from the less to the more. Now, as far as I know, there's not any, now I'm an ignoramus about this, I'm not a evolutionary specialist, but as far as I know, there's not any unequivocal example of macroevolution that's been put forth and approved by everybody. In other words, there isn't one example that everyone has that there's a consensus about.
Macroevolution then when Darwin, when people who believe in Darwinism say that we evolved from apes?
Sure, that would be macro. Macro would be from one species to another species, from a chimp to a man. Now, nobody actually thinks that we came from any particular primate that's alive today. They think that all the primates that are alive today and man have a common ancestor that would be this generic primate. And thus, the primates that are alive today evolved from them, specializing according to their particular biome, and man evolved in a different way, unspecializing, universalizing. And that's what I was trying to say at the beginning, seems improbable. Also, I don't know of any example, clear and unequivocal, that everyone accepts of microevolution, even in those things that reproduce so quickly that you would think it would be possible. Another question. You give the example of a monkey accidentally composing Macbeth and say there would be nobody to recognize it. Could you expand on what you mean by the word recognize? In other words, isn't precisely the increased fitness, meaning increased reproductive success of organisms, the recognition of happening mistakes? That's right. In other words, that's the theory. The theory is that it's precisely because a happy mistake is more fit that it will get recognized and selected. All I'm trying to say is that that won't always happen. Because just suppose you get this chance mutation and you get this marvelous 1 in a 10 billion incredibly unlikely accident, and then right after the thing's born, a shark comes by and swallows it up and it doesn't reproduce. Well, then you'll have to wait another. It's not as simple as, okay, you got this incredibly unlikely happy accident, and it's going to be naturally selected, because chances are it's going to be wiped out, just like most other things.
Would it also have to be two happy accidents?
Right. Right. That's another problem, right? In other words, it's not you just get Adam, just out of kind of from this primate to Adam, and then you've got to get Eve somehow. Right, and so, and you not only have to get the Adam and Eve, you have to get them together. And then you have to get them where there are no lines right next to them. I'm sorry, but it's fine. But in other words, it's not as easy as people tend to make out on the blackboard. That's why it's not so easy for it to get recognized. Because there could be, for example, the original life, people say, well, you have this primeval ocean, you have this kind of soup of proteins, and you get some lightning bolts, and you get the perfect combination of the. And the thing that makes it possible is you get all these lightning bolts. Well, the lightning bolts are going to destroy as well as create order.
Example of
that was the hypothesis of the original origin of life, that you had the kind
of upgrading, going to a
higher level.
Yeah. What example would there be?
Well, sure. Sure, or going from a plant to an animal. In other words, the first thing that has senses in addition.
The plant suddenly waved its hand.
Well, forget senses.
Yeah. And I guess they have plants. Or maybe.
Not that I know of. But, question back.
Oh, I was just going to say, you had said that the idea of the plant can strike in and that it can also destroy a lot of them.
Right.
But isn't part of it, though, that, I mean, at least at that very primeval level, that those would probably be asexual organisms that probably don't need another one around to reproduce?
That's true. But just think of that. That's true. It might. But the very. Right. That's right. That's the idea. But the real problem there is another. The real problem is that the unlikeliness, I mean, it's a mathematical thing. If you look at all the components that have to come together for that first, there's no consensus on the origin of life. Right? That's an unsolved problem. There was a famous a Russian scientist who came up with this theory, and then it was somebody in a lab made a situation like what they thought was the primeval ocean, and they added electricity, and you got some proteins. But it's one thing to get some proteins, and it's nothing to get a cell. Right? The cell is immensely more complex than these proteins. Do Mormons believe in evolution of spirit with their own systems and materially? I don't know. I'm not really sure what Mormons hold about this. So I'll have to pass on that. Is there such a thing as evolution of grace? No, right? Grace is utterly supernatural. And so grace can't evolve because what can evolve is what's material. Right? What's spiritual can't evolve. That's why the human soul can't evolve. Well, grace, I mean, because I think a lot of people have this idea of indefinite progress, that the inanimate gradually evolved to become animate. The animate plant evolved to become animal. The brute animal evolved to become human, and the human evolved to get grace. Right? Grace doesn't evolve. It's from above, not from below. Okay. Can we say then that Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, etc., prehistoric man, were possibly not even human? They possibly never had a soul. They were just a higher form of animal. That's possible. See, we don't know. We don't know at what point you pass from a brute animal to a rational animal. But the point is, it's got to be. But here's what I would say as a criterion. If you find skeletons that have the same size brain as we do, it's more reasonable to think that they are rational animals, because that's the predisposition of the body that you would need to get a rational soul. In other words, to get a rational soul, you need internal senses that are more highly developed. Right? And so if you find that the Neanderthal has a larger brain case than we do, it's more reasonable to think that those are human beings. In other words, the species, it doesn't, that from the philosophical or theological point of view, you're a human being if you're a rational animal. It doesn't matter whether you're a different race, like a Neanderthal or a Cro-Magnon. That's another question. In other words, what makes you a human being from the point of view that we're talking about here is to be rational. Right? So I'm totally ignorant, but it seems to me, based simply on brain capacity and the use of tools, that Neanderthal were human beings. Right? There would be another race of human beings.
Well, I agree with what I was going to say. I think even from a scientific definition of species, not mm-hmm.
right.
You could probably say they were too, because
right.
I guess there's evidence now that...
Of interbreeding.
That there was evidence of interbreeding.
That's right. Somebody has come up with something like, they even know a percentage, 5% interbreeding in different places. Between Neanderthals and interbreeding.
So how does that fit into the realm of things to where I mean, how does that fit in with Adam and Eve?
Right, so we'd have to think, in Genesis, there's an interesting passage that's very hard to explain about the intermating of the sons of God and the sons and daughters of men. We don't know how to understand that, but I'll say one thing that's impossible. The sons of God are angels. That's impossible, because angels can't interbreed with human beings. Some people read it that way. The more reasonable reading is you've got two different races of men interbreeding there in that passage of Genesis. The sons of God would be the descendants of the line of Seth, because they were the ones that worshipped God and called on his name. The sons and daughters of men, it's reasonable to think, were the descendants of Cain. And Genesis gives us these two different lines. And if that's some memory of Neanderthal men, perhaps, we simply don't know. But that would be a hypothesis. Yeah, I don't know the details, but the point is, you know, when you see pictures of Neanderthal, the artist is putting in, you know, some more than what is simply there in the skeleton. The fact is that they have, you know, large brain cases. Anyway, this is going beyond my knowledge. And it's not necessary for us to, in other words, the key thing in theology is to stay high enough on the level of principles. Once you start descending too much, you're bound to make all kinds of mistakes, because the science changes. And so if we want to, a big temptation for the theologian is to, well, I think we'll just modify original sin so I can keep up with what evolutionists are saying today. Well, what they're saying today, they're going to say something different tomorrow. And so I'm going to have to be continually revising my doctrine of original sin. Right? And so it's better to stay up on the level of principle. And then, you know, we'll see. Okay. Another question. It seems the Bible doesn't allow time or an explanation for different designs of the human race, all equal. But the dark skin in Africans predict them from sun, Asians with the fold of the eyes, lips, etc. In other words, can you explain evolution, bodily change that the Bible doesn't explain? Well, sure, that's a perfect example of microevolution. In other words, that their different races be adapted to different climates is exactly what you would expect. Right? That's the microevolution that we observe in breeding, in all kinds of in the animal world. Right? And so that there be variations of all of which are human beings, some more suited to different environments, well, that's perfectly reasonable. Right? That's the evolution that everyone agrees on. Right, and the Bible doesn't go into that because the Bible doesn't claim to explain all these things. Right. Sure, I'm not competent to decide. That's something that we can leave for those who are more competent to work out. One last question. If a bang, the Big Bang, produced an explosion, where the particles go off in all separate directions, how do the proponents of this theory negotiate the coming together of the material? In other words, how do you explain galaxies and so forth? Well, again, this is way behind me. But this is a beautiful example of what scientists call the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is the idea that when you look at all the different laws of nature, you see that it's as if all of these laws of nature that would regulate things like gravity, the different atomic forces, what scientists call the weak force, the strong force, other different forces, and all kinds of constants that are written into the natural laws. It sure looks like they're perfectly coordinated to permit human life. Just take one example. If gravity had been a little stronger than it is, you would have had, all right, maybe a big bang, but then a big crunch. And you wouldn't have had a universe with galaxies. Or suppose you took the law of gravity and made it ever so slightly less. Everything would have dispersed so much, because there wouldn't have been that, again, there wouldn't have formed the galaxies and the solar systems and the planets that we have. And the difference, apparently, is so small. Now it's this constant that you've got huge stretch. All of these numbers on this side, big crunch. All the numbers on this side that God could have picked, or that could have somehow been selected by, again, dispersion. No, and the right, in other words, the one that enables us to be here is this very precise number that just so happens to be the number that's in the law of gravity. That's pretty remarkable by itself. But then it's even far more remarkable when you consider that there's not just one of these laws of nature, but there's like 30, or maybe that was outdated when I was reading 30. Maybe there's more. And all of them are perfectly coordinated one with another, because that's not just 1 in 30, right? We said that's 1 in 10 to the 30th. And if each one of those is unbelievably improbable, the collection of them all is far more. So again, it would come to the same result. It sure looks as if nature was perfectly, beautifully, incredibly designed so as to make possible, let us make man in our image and likeness. All right, on that note, I think we have to call it a night.